Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he was 19 years old when he came ashore on D-Day, June 6th, 1944.
I was petrified. Anybody who says that they weren't didn't have their head on straight.
Eventually, he'd be wounded, but he survived, and something he left behind in a French field 69 years ago just made it back to him. Don't miss this veteran's remarkable story today at 1 on KMJ, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every weekend. Each week we visit with veterans, primarily from our World War II generation. The idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget how much our freedom cost. And along the way, I think we're educated and inspired and sometimes taken aback by the incredible nature of some of these stories. It's fun when there's a postscript, something more recent, a late development that we can add to the story, and that is certainly the case this week. Maybe you caught this in the national news. I'm joined by 88-year-old Irving Mann of Rochester, New York, and he's had quite the experience lately, but we're going to go back to the past, more than 70 years in the past. And Mr. Mann, you grew up in Western New York, I understand, right?
Buffalo, New York.
What was life like in Buffalo, New York in the 20s and 30s and early 40s?
Well, it was, I didn't really have a chance to really taste much of that because while my father and his father and my uncle had a jewelry store and watchmaking shop in Buffalo, New York, it was when I was about 2 years old that a tragedy struck the family, and I guess it was flu. Within 13 months, I lost my grandfather, my uncle, and my mother, my grandmother, I should say, and they were all stricken. And when my father lost so much of his family, he put the key in the door in Buffalo and came to Rochester, New York, where we had relatives. And they persuaded him that he could do well in the city. And he came to Rochester and in 1930 opened up his little jewelry store, watch repair shop. At that time, I was born in 1925, so I was 5 years old. He opened up a store under the name of Al, A-L, the Watchdog, and he became pretty well known in the local market as a master watchmaker. He took care of the railroad watches for those people who required exact time. And I grew up in that store. From 1930 on, I used to come to the store and watch how the jewelry business was being run. I attended the public school there and the high school, Franklin High in Rochester, New York. When I graduated, I was presented with two diplomas. One was a diploma for graduating from Franklin High School in Rochester. The other from Uncle Sam, saying, "Welcome, join our crowd." Words to that effect. I didn't really have much choice. So, and in 1943, I was inducted into the service. So I was sent down to Camp Van Dorn, Mississippi, for our basic training.
And I want to hear about that, and we're going to hear about how you earned the Purple Heart, how long you had to wait to get the Purple Heart, and how you received the Bronze Star, and what recent development there's been, too. But I know there's something along that timeline that happened before you graduated, and Uncle Sam sent you his version of your diploma. In December 1941, I'm sure it was a very cold winter in upstate New York. I went to college there. I know what those winters are like. But December 7th, 1941, the world changed a little bit. Did it change for you? Do you remember how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
Well, at the time, of course, I was still going to school, and it was shocking to hear about. And we began to hear of various neighbors and friends whose families were now rather disrupted by volunteering to go into service, and the Selective Service portion of our government was requesting that those who were able to join the service would soon become part of this national effort. And you sort of knew that sooner or later, I would probably become a part of that.
Well, so it didn't necessarily catch you by surprise when Uncle Sam said, I want you.
Not really. Part of that is because I had great-grandparents who lived in Europe at the time.
Mm.
And my mother had been getting letters from that particular part of the world, and the handwriting seemed to be on the wall. So much so that eventually we got some letters with a black border saying that my grandmother and then my grandfather had passed away.
Mm.
How they passed away and what the method was, or whether it was with the aid and abetting of Adolf Hitler, I never did find out. But we knew they were gone, and we never heard any more from the rest of the family. I had cousins and who I never had met, and they just simply disappeared. So I can only assume that they were part of that very terrible time.
And I guess it's important to note for our listeners that you are of Jewish American descent.
Correct.
So you had a clue that your ancestors and these people, your relatives back in Europe, may be being persecuted by this Nazi regime.
I'm afraid that what occurred was eventually no secret.
Mm-hmm.
We heard rumors and the stories from some of those who had the good fortune to escape from that particular part of the world, but there wasn't very much we could do about it.
Was your understanding clear or developed enough as you joined the service to add extra motivation, perhaps, that what you were going over to fight against, this was a worthy cause and something that you had a personal reason to be involved in?
Absolutely. And as part of my job as a combat infantryman, we'd get some prisoners in during combat, and I was able to interrogate them with a little bit of the language that they spoke, and would ask the question, what outfit are you in, and words of that nature, and it would say, and I would identify myself at the time that I was Jewish. And that usually provoked some more response from the prisoners than I would normally have gotten, I think.
Mm, I can imagine. And we'll get to those moments of the war, but you're heading overseas, and you're just a teenager. Do you remember what was going through your mind when you headed across the Atlantic, knowing that there were some battles ahead?
Well, we didn't really know where we were going to go. They at first, we did the combat in this country, with basic training down in Mississippi, and then maneuvers, and then they shipped us to England, where we did some of the activities where we learned about storming beaches and preparing for an invasion. But we had no idea that we would be going to France.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, the scuttlebutt was that we were headed for Sicily.
Huh.
And so when they got us on a boat after our training, and we were headed into the English Channel, the story was pretty complete that, yes, we were heading for Italy, that there were some airfields, German airfields in Italy, in Sicily, that we would be removing from the German Reich, and there would be a beach attack. And that seemed to be so strong that we were prepared. I thought to myself, you know, I never learned how to speak Italian, so maybe it's a little late now. But anyhow, we were about halfway across the English Channel when over the loudspeaker of the ship came the word from President Roosevelt notifying us that we were not going to Sicily. We were, in fact, headed for the French coast to begin, as he put it, the greatest adventure of our lives, free the world from Nazism. So by that time, we got a little bit more excited, shall I say, and nerved up, and started to check our equipment.
And what kind of equipment did you have as an infantryman?
Well, I had an M1 rifle, as most of us had, but in addition to that, I was being trained as a radio operator with an SCR 300. This is a radio that weighs about 30 pounds and to be carried on the back of a soldier. So that was extra training that I got aboard ship as well.
So that's a 30-pound radio on your back. And how much did you weigh?
120. I was 5'6" and 120 pounds. And the radio was 30 pounds. And with that, I switched from an M1 rifle to a carbine. And it was a little bit lighter. And hand grenades and sidearms. That sort of, I think I probably weighed an additional 50 pounds by the time they loaded me all up.
I believe it. And by this time, as you're heading across the channel, you had already been assigned to the 90th Infantry Division, is that right?
Well, we actually were in the 63rd Infantry Division.
Uh-huh.
Under Bradley.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And,
however, after we hit the beach and got inland, we were informed that our outfit was now designated as part of the 90th Infantry Division under General Patton.
And this, the beach you're talking about is Utah Beach on Normandy, and this
Utah
is D-Day,
beach.
Right?
Yeah, that was, and we landed on the evening of D-Day.
What did you see there? Because obviously we've heard the stories and stories about Omaha Beach and how brutal that was and how concentrated the resistance was there. What did you encounter at Utah Beach when you went ashore?
Well, of course, there was a little chaos, quite a bit of confusion. We didn't know really where we were because with the artillery, both from the German pillboxes from one standpoint and the high ground, and the other was from the from our own naval guns that had been firing for quite some time and trying to remove the barbed wire entanglements that had been set up by the German people, by the German government. And the mortar fire and the rifle fire, machine gun fire, was fairly intense. But I guess they hit it a lot harder at Omaha Beach. So we got in, and one of the things that really impressed me was standing on the beach, almost at attention, was a British soldier set up in his regalia, his uniform, actually in the middle of all this, designating when he asked what outfit, and we gave him the that we were 90th Infantry. He pointed in the direction. So as our landing barge let out our people, he was pointing that 90th Infantry this way. It was still pretty confusing, but I thought, my God, if you talk about guts, here's a guy in the middle of all this acting as a traffic cop.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't get over it.
Yeah, I would imagine the last thing you want to be in a situation like that is a stationary target.
Right.
And that's what he was.
That's what he was.
Mm.
That night we spent all night long we were in, under an apple tree orchard, and we had our little clickers with us, which were handed out by the government. These are these little toys that click, click, and that was to identify whether you have a buddy somewhere in the area or whether or not later on the Germans had gotten onto that, and they took the clickers from prisoners and dead soldiers, and they tried to trick us by clicking those clickers so that we would think that it was other GIs. But we caught on to that after a while, too.
What I'm trying to put myself in your shoes here, or your boots as the case may be, and you're a couple months past your 19th birthday. There's artillery fire everywhere, and you're settling in for that night trying to maybe catch a little bit of shut-eye. What in the world was going through your mind? Were you scared? What do you think you were thinking at the time?
I was petrified.
Mm.
And anybody who says that they weren't didn't have their head on straight, because you didn't know where you were and what you were going to face when daylight came.
Daylight would come on June 7th, 1944, and we're going to hear about that when we continue. Irving Mann of Rochester, New York is our guest this week. He made headlines around the globe recently when something he lost during the war made it back to him nearly 70 years later. We're going to get to that as well. You can find some photos and other links on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after I tell you about one of my favorite places in my hometown. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Los Banos. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Los Banos is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Los Banos, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest this week is 88-year-old Irving Mann of Rochester, New York. He is one tough hombre. Maybe you recognize that as the nickname of the 90th Infantry Division. That's the outfit he served with during World War II. We're going to hear about how he earned the Purple Heart and about another piece of metal that recently made its way back to him after all these years. It's quite the story. When we left off, though, he was talking about June 6th, 1944, when he came ashore on Normandy's Utah beach that fateful evening. Half a world away, Americans slowly got the news via radio. And here's a little sample of what you might have heard on these very airwaves way back then. First, here's Quentin Reynolds, CBS Radio.
The words of the communique announcing the landings were brief and cold and factual. We don't know how many men landed on enemy territory as yet. We don't know how many places they landed. We don't know whether their trip across the water was a hard one, constantly hampered by German aircraft. We only know that last night one man said two words. Eisenhower said, "Let's go," and the invasion was on. There are 1,000 stories behind the short communique which merely told us that our men had landed. Those of us who have been on other amphibious landings can imagine how our men felt last night when they were finally told that their long months of waiting were over. As long as these men live, the evening of June 5th will always be to them the night before D-Day. And if they live to be 100, June 6th will forever be D-Day to them.
And it certainly is for Irving Mann, who came ashore June 6th on Utah Beach. More from him in a moment. But first, something else heard over the airwaves on June 6th, 1944. You talk about putting things in perspective. I don't know that I've heard a better two-minute synopsis of what the Allied invasion of Europe meant than this from the one and only Bob Hope.
Folks, this is Bob Hope speaking from a P-38 airfield out here near Van Nuys, California. We look forward to being with these men and doing our regular show here, but of course nobody feels like getting up and being funny on a night like this. But we did want to go through with our plans and visit with these fellas because these are the same kind of boys that are flying those 11,000 planes on our big effort. What's happened during these last few hours, not one of us will ever forget. How could you forget? You sat up all night by the radio and heard the bulletins, the flashes, the voices coming across from England. The commentators, the pilots returning from their greatest of all missions, newsboys yelling in the street, and it seemed that one world was ending and a new world beginning. That history was closing one book and opening a new one. And somehow we knew it had to be a better one. You sat there and dawn began to sneak in and you thought of the hundreds of thousands of kids you'd seen in camps the past 2 or 3 years. The kids who scream and whistle when they hear a gag in a song. And now you could see all of them again in 4,000 ships in the English Channel, tumbling out of thousands of planes over Normandy and the occupied coast. In countless landing barges crashing the Nazi gate and going on through to do the job that's the job of all of us. The sun came up and you sat there looking at that huge black headline. That one great black word with the exclamation point, invasion. The one word that the whole world has waited for, that all of us have worked for. We knew we'd wake up one morning and have to meet it face to face. The word in which America's invested everything these 30 long months. the efforts of millions of Americans building planes and weapons, the shipyards and the men who took the stuff across, little kids buying war stamps and housewives straining bacon grease, farmers working around the clock, millions of young men sweating it out in camps and fighting the battles that paved the way for that headline this morning. Now the investment must pay for this generation and all generations to come. And folks, what a wonderful thing it is that no matter the price, the reward will be greater than the sacrifice. We hope that thought can go along with the prayer tonight, the prayer of a whole nation. God bless those kids across the English Channel.
One of those kids across the English Channel was then 19-year-old Irving Mann, a combat infantryman with the 90th Infantry Division. When we left off, he talked about finally settling in on the night of June 6th and not knowing what he might face once the sun rose the next morning.
When daylight came, we followed the directions that had been given, looked for a rallying point, you might say, in a little town, little area called St. Mary Glees. Which was, I guess in French, it's the Church by the Sea.
Yeah.
We headed for that and found it before. It wasn't that far away. And there was gliders that had smashed into the ground because gliders without motors had no way to averting the landing.
Yeah.
So the gliders had smashed up, obviously, the paratroopers and those glider pilots who were handling those. There were a lot of bodies around. And up in the steeple of this particular church was a parachutist whose parachute had hung up on the steeple, and his body was swaying back and forth, and the Germans had used him for target practice. So his body was waving back and forth until somebody went up there and cut him down.
That's
the initial memory will never leave any of us who were there at the time. Then we proceeded to join the rest of our troops. We found that little by little we all got together and formed a fighting troop and proceeded to go on to our various assignments.
I can't imagine what that must have been like. Was there anything that helped you deal with it, with the chaos, with the casualties, with the fear? Was there something that you look back and say, you know what, that helped me get through those days?
I can only think of one thing, and that is prayer. And I don't care what religion, I don't care what people believe in or say they believe in. The phrase, there are no atheists in foxholes, struck me and stayed with me all the time I was in service. Because all you can do, since you're helpless otherwise, is to pray and dig foxholes as deep as you can. And I could dig at 19. I was able to dig foxholes very fast, very deep, and that plus the prayers are the things that got us through.
Oh, that makes sense to me. Is that something that was a product of your upbringing and the way your family saw the world, or is that something
to
you just developed there?
Yes, I had training in that area, as so many of us have, in whatever the religion may be, but the belief that it is an all-powerful being, and you're hoping that you won't be one of those bodies that ends up either in the ground or in the water.
And I imagine along that way, and we'll talk about what you guys did in the 90th Infantry Division as you raced across France and had some key battles where you emerged victorious, but I imagine along that way you lost a friend or two, a guy you had gotten to know a little bit. Is that true?
Yes, that's very true. There's so many, but in the time that I was there, we had one area where we had dug in, and we weren't under direct fire at the time, but we knew the Germans weren't too far away from us, and so I dug my little foxhole both into the side of a hedgerow and down in deep, and one of the other fellows had dug his foxhole not too far away, but he didn't dig it too deep. So things at that point seemed to be a little quiet. And just as we were sort of relaxing, you might say, with no immediate fire coming our direction, the 82nd Airborne paratroopers came through our position, and they drew fire from the artillery and mortars, etc., from the Germans that sort of spotted our position as a result of the paratroopers coming through. And before the paratroopers could get far enough away and remove that particular group of Germans, they really hit us very, very hard with all the mortars and machine guns. And all we could do is cower in our foxholes. Unfortunately, this one of my buddies, who hadn't dug too deep, came running over, took a running jump, and landed on top of me. He was about 6 foot two, 6 foot three, weighed about 200 pounds.
Ooh.
And I said, you know, get the hell off of me. Words to that effect. He said, shh. Of course, he said, remember, I'm 120 pounds and not too big. And he said, shut up. He says, can't you hear that those mortars are zinging overhead? So I shut up, and we could hear the shrapnels zinging over our heads, the mortars and the artillery, the 88s, which were a terrible weapon that the Germans owned, were coming in our direction. And finally, it quieted down. We got the signal to retreat and go back to our original position. And when I tried to get him off my back and get out from underneath, thinking he was fooling around, I rolled him over, and unfortunately, the mortars had hit him. I killed him, and he had passed away.
Wow.
The back of his head had been hit with a mortar. That vision never leaves you.
Well, and I imagine there's another element to that, and I don't want to make you dwell on this too long, but isn't there an element of that when you survived that, and there were other things you'd survive, and it's pretty amazing that you've been able to come back and continue your family legacy in the jewelry business and do everything you've done, but you look at a moment like that, and had he not jumped on top of you, that 88 would have perhaps gotten you. You wouldn't be talking to me right now.
There's any question about that.
Yeah.
And the question I was asking myself was, why him and not me?
Mm.
And that's a question, of course, I'll never be able to answer, nor will anyone else. But I guess there was something, somebody upstairs was looking out for me at the time, whether through prayer or accident or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can't rationalize that. So, yes, there were other times that were pretty close. And when I finally did get hit, we were about to attempt a water crossing of the Saar River. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and as we headed for the river with our rubber boats, all hell broke loose. The Germans had flares and made it like daylight.
Mm.
The next thing I knew, I was on the ground looking up, and somebody near me was yelling, medic, medic. And I really wasn't in that much pain. I always had wondered what's going to feel like to get hit, because you anticipate at some point or other. You can't be lucky forever. The medics came and picked me up in a stretcher, took me and put me on a Jeep and got me out of the area. I don't know how many other people we lost at the time. And I could hear the medics say to themselves, oh, his leg looks pretty bad. I guess he's going to lose his leg.
Mm.
And at the point, I thought, get me out of here, regardless. They couldn't do anything at the medic. The medics weren't able to do anything. They took me to aid station a little bit further back. And then they took one look and said, get this guy on a plane. They got me to a nearby airport, and along with a few other people who'd been hit, we were on our way across the English Channel, going the other way this time. Ended up in a hospital in Cheltenham, England. They had very, very talented doctors and surgeons, and I went through several surgeries. They did save the leg. I got some souvenirs from it, but which I'm still carrying. But got me to England, and after 4 months, they got me on crutches. So that was the end of my combat days, though.
Well, and you say it, you got some souvenirs from it, and you got another piece of metal here recently that we're going to talk about eventually. But what you're telling me is you still have shrapnel in that leg.
Yeah, I still have 13 little pieces of shrapnel, but they're so small that I can even go through an MRI without distress. So
good.
So they're tiny.
And if you can put into perspective for our listeners, how severe was this damage to your leg, and what were you thinking? Did you believe you'd be able to save that leg, or were you preparing for life without a leg?
At first, I was thinking, what's it going to be like with a wooden leg?
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of thoughts went through my mind. But at that point, the idea was I was still alive. In some ways, I was still a lucky one. A lot of people came out of that and weren't that lucky.
Well, and I guess especially when you consider what your division was doing during those months where you were in England recovering.
Yes, I lost complete track of them. I didn't have any idea. I did know that 3 days later, the Germans had counterattacked with Bastogne, the Battle of the Bulge, and the hospitals became loaded with wounded soldiers. In some ways, I felt I was probably lucky I was still alive, because the hospital became packed with soldiers who had been wounded badly, very badly. A lot of them didn't make it. So I considered myself to be fortunate. If I had to be hit, that was a good time to be hit.
Yeah, timing really was everything. At that point, you could be evacuated. Had you been wounded later, they would have been so overloaded, maybe they couldn't give you the attention or get you out of there. And then your division was in on the last half of the Battle of the Bulge, too. So had you not been hit, you might have been dealing with some of the worst days of that infamous battle.
I think you're right. I've considered that quite often.
What was the biggest challenge for you, the biggest hurdle to overcome during all those months recuperating from that wound?
Well, actually, I was wondering whether or not I was going to be spending the rest of my life on one leg or not. At the time, before I went into service, while I was in school, my ambition had been to go into medicine. I had taken some courses to lead to that area when I entered college. Still, to this day, I've always thought about how life can change, because after the wound and after I went through what so many GIs go through to make a decision, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And my decision after that was that if I were to go into the medicine, I would have 10 years in front of me of education that would require education, internships, specialization, that kind of thing. And so I switched my life career from medicine to the family profession. And I attended a Canadian college for watchmakers on the GI Bill and became a master watchmaker. And it was then led to my opening up of my own. I got married while I was there to a Canadian girl. And we came back to Rochester, and I opened up our first store in 1949, and it's been going ever since. My daughter is the CEO of Mann Jewelers, and my son is the president of Mann Jewelers, and Irving Mann, the old man, is still the chairman of the board.
Good for you. Well, and I just have to play master of the obvious here as you talk about your son and your daughter carrying on this family business. And a lot of people in Rochester wouldn't have gotten their watches or their jewelry or had to go somewhere else for it. Your son and daughter would have never been born, and you never would have met your wife if you didn't survive all of that overseas.
That's right. She was a most wonderful partner for 59 years, passed away about 6 years ago, which was the most horrible loss. But all of that would never have happened, and I wouldn't be here today talking to you if things had turned out differently.
Well, I'm so glad they worked out exactly the way they did, including the latest chapter. Who would have seen this twist coming? Talk about a needle in a haystack. How about a dog tag in a barley field? We'll get that heartwarming postscript to Irving Mann's story when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch right after this. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and another reminder this week of the idea behind that moniker, that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, men and women who have endured a lot more than we could really imagine for the sake of our freedom. We're getting a taste of that this week from Irving Mann. He opened a jewelry store in Rochester, New York, almost 65 years ago, and he received a very unique package there recently. Normally, I meet up with our veterans in person, but this week, with his story making headlines all over the place, I thought connecting via the telephone would be worth it to hear from Mr. Mann, not just his intense experiences that he's described for us so far, his time in the 90th Infantry Division, but the incredible twist that unfolded here in 2013. So let's work our way there, Mr. Mann. Take it away.
About a year ago, I had a call from the French government. The attaché in New York had called, and it seemed that they were gathering together some GIs who had been in on the invasion of Normandy. And there were 42 of us who they gathered and invited us to come to New York City for a celebration. They weren't too specific, but we had all been in, as they say, on the invasion of Normandy. And we gathered together. 42 of us were then presented by the French official with a kiss on each cheek, a hug, and the French Medal of Honor. After so many years to get this final decoration was very, very touching. And in my store, I have sort of conference room where these decorations are on display, so that when I'm not around anymore, my children and their friends and our customers will have a chance to see, what did your dad do during the Second World War?
Well, that is a great legacy, and that's not the only thing that has come to you a long time after what you did. I do want to ask you one more question, though, about World War II, and you talked about being injured and recovering. What about coming home, coming back to the States, knowing what you had done, what so many other Americans had done? What did it feel like to get back home again, to see your family again?
Well, it was very unreal. I had never really had wondered if that would ever happen. But then I felt very strongly that I had to get on with my life. What happened, happened. God was very good to me, allowed me to come back and renew a life that could have been easily ended so many times. And that now it was up to me and my family to sort of pay back the country, the people, and the other GIs who have been fighting since. At 88, of course, nobody knows how much longer I'll still be around, but I think only in this country could we have gone through all of that and still have a full life after that.
Amen. And when you heard, when you saw news reports, newspaper photos or newsreels, and realized the graphic nature of what had happened to the Jewish people in Europe. In fact, your division, the 90th, was one of the liberators of the Flossenbürg concentration camp.
Right.
When you saw the depth, the gravity, the horrors of the Holocaust, what did that do to you?
Well, the hatred for that particular regime was such that I figured we did something to hopefully create a situation worldwide that would never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I belong to a few organizations where some of the members are people who were in the concentration camps at that time and have come to Rochester and established successful businesses and discussing what they encountered during those horrible days for them, where they didn't have a chance to fight back. They saw their friends, relatives, family being decimated, and here they are. They've been able to reconstitute their lives in very meaningful ways. So I feel very fortunate, and fortunate to know that people like that still exist, who took everything that happened to them and were able to start new lives and pay back to this country for our efforts in freeing them from what they had been going through.
Yeah, and you gave a big part of yourself in that effort and suffered wounds in the process. And speaking of those wounds, I heard you say how grateful you were just to get back to this country and to have that chance at life. And maybe that's why you never made a big deal out of your wounds and didn't make a fuss about getting your Purple Heart. But just a few years ago, you got that Purple Heart. What did that feel like all those years later to finally get that medal and everything that comes with it?
Thank you, Senator Schumer.
Yeah, we should hear some good stories about our legislators every once in a while, right?
After we found out later, of course, that the records of our Purple Hearts had been stored in a warehouse in St. Louis, which had burned down. And that's the reason the VA and the other organizations were never able to trace it, even though I applied a number of times to the VA, et cetera. Years passed, decades passed, and they just drew a blank. But dear Senator Schumer, with all his abilities and sensitivities to what I felt and other people have felt, he was able to research it, cut through the red tape, and made the presentation before my family and myself directly to present me with this Purple Heart. I thought that was that's the biggest piece of hardware that I have.
Uh-huh. Well, and you've had your hands on a lot of precious gems over the years, a lot of gold and silver necklaces and bracelets and rings and watches. Sounds like that little Purple Heart medal means a little more to you.
It did. There was one other issue that... April the 22nd, a French woman, 36-year-old woman who lives on a farm, I'm trying to remember what kind of farm it was.
A barley farm, I believe.
Barley
right?
farm, that's right.
Yeah.
And near a little town called Rethel, or the Ardennes area of France, contacted my daughter-in-law by email, my daughter-in-law working in the store and handling the electronic media, wondered whether or not there was an Irving man in that store who fought in the French liberation. So she said yes and wondered if that Irving man was still alive. And she said, yes, he is. And it turned out that while she was in her barley field, she saw a glint of metal, bent down, picked it up, and it was a dog tag that I had lost. Never even remembered losing it. And she contacted her through email, contacted our store through email, refused to get any kind of reward, but was anxious to send it to me, so I would have the extra little bit of souvenir of my time in France. And I remember the details, which were quite interesting. We had stopped for a rest stop, you might say, near the little town of Rethel in France, and, of course, dug in deeply from the same old foxholes. And possibly while I was digging that foxhole, I may have lost part of my dog tags. There are two on a chain, and I never remembered losing it. But there in her field, she found my dog tag, a little beat up. But there it was with my name, my serial number, my blood type, religion, all that sort of thing was in the dog tag, beat up, as I say. But it was mine, there's no question. At first, I thought it was a scam, somebody trying to get some money, but she... certainly wasn't. She was very honorable and very straightforward about wanting to get the dog tag to me. And as we speak, I now am holding it in my hand. It arrived, and I thanked her electronically, and I naturally sent her a little souvenir from me with a little a fleur-de-lis necklace set up in small diamonds that remind her how much I appreciated her efforts to locate me. And that, I guess, is the best part of the, you might say, the finis to my adventures.
Yeah, that is really incredible. It's something that you didn't even realize you had lost, but now to get it back. I it sounds like it means the world to you to have something back that you didn't even know you lost.
That was the extra part. That's something that I would never, ever have thought, that something of that nature would have suddenly shown up after 69 years. When I first heard about it, I said, what are the chances? And I'm a little bit of a gambler, maybe. That's what business is all about. But I said to myself, in 69 years, how many times has that field been plowed? How many times has it been tilled? How many times has it been planted? And each time, they had to be digging in that area where my dog tag was lying. And what brought it to the surface at that particular time, where this woman would have found it? It was extraordinary. And as I said to one of the reporters, I consider it to be miraculous. Absolutely miraculous that this would come to me after 69 years.
And since this story has made some headlines, and there's a terrific article in the Rochester newspaper that I'll link online, and it's been picked up across the country and across the globe, I imagine I'm not the only one who's given you a call about it. Have you had some neat experiences with people inquiring about this dog tack and your reunion with it?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, at first, of course, I heard from other GIs here in Rochester and New York State. And then I began to hear from people. And as a matter of fact, even today, I heard from somebody in San Jose who was a GI and was part of the adjoining regiment. I was in the 358th Regiment of the 90th, and this person was in the 357th Regiment of the 90th Infantry and wanted to touch base and see what my experiences had been after we got out. And then my son had a roommate in college who had originally come from Rome, Italy, and he's gone back to Rome since and established a business. And we got a email from him to my son saying, I just read about your father. I don't know how long this is going to keep up, but it's very entertaining and exciting.
Yeah, it gives you something to look forward to for sure and to be excited about every day. What, if you could put into words what all of this has taught you or illuminated for you, what would that be?
Well, I think that I have to say that that life isn't over until it's over. You never know what tomorrow is going to bring. As those of us who are as fortunate as I have been in the past, you have to appreciate each and every day as each and every day comes through and really thank the powers that be for all the good things they give us. Unfortunately, we sometimes temper it with some things that are not so good, but this really testifies to me that you got to keep hope up.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to say on behalf of our listeners, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story, because I think it does give the rest of us some hope and some inspiration. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know about you and your fellow World War II veterans and what we need to remember about the Greatest Generation?
The only thing I could add to that would be listening to what's going on in Congress just recently to say to these to our representatives, we worked pretty hard to do what's been accomplished up to now. Don't screw it up.
That's a good way of putting it. I like that. Well, thanks again, Mr. Mann. And the next time I'm in Rochester, I'm going to come by and check out those medals on the wall of your jewelry store there.
Well, Mann Jewelers is just about, after all of these years, since 1949, when I opened up that little store with my wife in 1949, and now that my children have expanded it and establish it in our community, they're just about to open a second jewelry store.
Well, like I said, I guess it's a good thing you made it home from the war then.
It sure is.
If you listen to Hometown Heroes regularly, you've heard that before. That is the common denominator with all of these stories, isn't it? And so many of us, myself included, would not be here if our fathers or grandfathers did not return. I hope you enjoyed Irving Mann's story as much as I did, and I hope you'll join us again next week for another installment of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once again that freedom is not free.